your attention to start with. We'll see how it goes as the talk goes forward. This is probably one of the few audiences I actually have to apologize for not having equations in the talk. It's usually the other way around, of course. The talk, I'll give you the overview right now, the outline of what I'm going to try and cover in, say, roughly 45 minutes. There's two major sections to the talk. One is a sort of theoretical foundation, and the second part is really on sort of the empirical realization of different ways to test that theory. So the notion is that we're trying to look at how to think about structural networks and how structure constraints function, then how to understand those functions from the perspective of dynamical systems and how that constrains how we think then about how cognition emerges from these networks. So the first part of the talk will just go through this idea of neural context. It's one of the principles that we've been developing over the last decade or so. And then the bulk of the rest of the talk will actually talk about noise and variability as being a important driver of network dynamics, both in terms of sort of oscillations that you see are sort of the idling of the brain, but also in enabling the switch between different cognitive processes. So in fact, the noise is an enabler, or what's called kinetic energy, that allows the brain to adopt different configurations for different cognitive functions. So we'll go through the definition of brain noise. That's quite an important distinction. In the examples, we'll cover brain maturation in kids through to teenagers, healthy aging. I'll touch a little bit on some of the clinical conditions, which you see these changes in the noise profiles. As before, I do encourage you to ask questions along the way. Please feel free to interrupt at any point, except for you, if there are any questions. The guy behind you. So we've heard pieces of this part of the talk already, and I just want to emphasize how it is the unique configuration of the brain constrains the computational capacity of that system. And we have the spectrum of possible configurations here for a network that processes information, which includes the brain, of course. We have, for example, a situation where you've got independent nodes that each node does one and only one thing. So if you perturb the system here, the output will be a very deterministic sort of response. You will always get that response when you stimulate that node. Conversely, you have the redundant system, where it's very hard to indicate which of these nodes contributes to a given output. Every node contributes to an output in some way, shape, or form. And you have the what's called the degenerate case here, where you have overlapping constituents contributing to a function. There are a lot of consequences to these architectures, and there's a ton of literature out there, I'm sure you already know, about how these architectures constrain information processing. A couple of things to keep in mind, for instance, is that an independent system is quite robust in what it generates in terms of the performance or the behavior of that system. Not very fault tolerant, obviously, because if you knock out a node, you've lost that function. There's no way to recover that function easily. But it can have a fairly wide repertoire of things it can do. Conversely, a redundant system has much more fault tolerance, because if it has all nodes contributing to the same function, you knock out a node, the function could pretty much maintain itself to a point. But the repertoire of the system, the number of things it can do, is quite constrained because every node contributes to a function. And the brain, showing smaller architecture, degenerate architecture, etc., shows this intermediate configuration, where you, and it allows it to show maximum complexity, mathematically defined. And here we're emphasizing the aspect of complexity as being the ability to differentiate and integrate information. So given that, and this is actually something that sort of emerged as we looked over, at that point we were focusing a lot on neuroimaging literature, human neuroimaging in particular, that was really focused on localizing different parts of the brain that were attributed to certain functions, ignoring the fact that these hotspots you identify in the image are coming about because of changes in network dynamics, and a fairly distributed network at that. So the idea is that if you take into consideration the network, that the function of relevance, I should say, an activity change in one area may depend quite heavily on the activity of other parts of the brain. And that's an excerpt from one of the first papers we articulated the basic idea. This is a cartoon just showing you the concept, sort of in a highly stylized version, I guess. Cartoonish, if you will. You have the same four nodes here that are engaged, but by virtue of the fact that they're interacting with different other nodes in that network, you can call this frontal, you can call this ventral temporal, for instance, that the instantiating function, ensuing function that emerges from this network is quite different. Same nodes, but by virtue of the fact that it's a different context, you have a different function emerging from the combined effort of all these nodes. Now, if you start perusing the literature, in this case I'm focusing on imaging literature again, you find examples of these neural contexts popping up. One from Marcus Basito's group in Berkeley talking about the point that activation of prefrontal cortex, specifically the part of prefrontal cortex has been typically associated with working memory. That activation in and of itself does not guarantee that the subject is engaging in working memory. It's actually the activation of prefrontal cortex in concert with other parts of the brain that really is the best correlate, if you will, of whether working memory is happening or not. Some of our own work, one focused on changes in prefrontal cortex functional connections that relate to learning and awareness. A more recent study, well, relatively speaking, I guess. This is almost 10 years old now. It's kind of pathetic, isn't it? I'll talk about this study in a second, actually, and this, another one looking at the changes in the functional connections of anterior cingulate, again, depending on the context, and the context then having a behavioral consequence in terms of how it supports working memory. This is the example from the hippocampal study, and this, again, is another cartoon. Some of you, I know, are getting tired of seeing this cartoon, but I still like it because it's really colorful. That's why I keep on showing it. It's like perseverative behavior. Anyways, what we have here is a summary of an experiment that was done looking at associative learning, learning the relationship between two different tones and a visual stimulus. So it's called differential conditioning in the Pavlovian sense of the term, or classical conditioning sense of the term. One tone predicted the visual stimulus, one tone predicted the absence, so a CS plus, CS minus differentiation. And we reversed that contingency halfway through the experiment. So you have differential conditioning with reversal. Okay. Half of the subjects that were in the study, and this is completely serendipitous, it happened this way. Half of the subjects in the study learned both the facilitation that you see from having a paired stimulus. So they were always faster when they had a tone preceding the visual stimulus. They learned that pairing than when there was no tone. But they also learned differential. So they're actually much faster when it was a tone plus versus a tone minus. And they also reversed that when you change the contingencies. Importantly, they also told us that they knew that. So after we did the experiment, we debriefed them and asked them, what did you think of the experiment? You know, what was happening in there? Can you tell us something about the tones and the visual stimuli? And they articulated quite concisely what the relationship was. And they also know that it reversed. The other half of the subjects, and these were, you know, theoretically, somebody heard me somewhere. Theoretically, the unaware subjects that were in here were all normal undergraduates from the University of Toronto. But half the subjects showed no awareness of this relationship. They did show the facilitation of reaction time, but they didn't show the differential change in reaction time. So they showed no overt awareness of the contingencies. Interestingly, both groups, if you looked at their activity, brain activity, and how it related to behavior, both groups showed very strong correlations between activation of hippocampus and learning. The problem was that, at that point in time at least, there was a huge controversy in the memory literature at least as to whether or not the hippocampus was necessary for learning with awareness. And what our data suggests is that you can get learning that involves hippocampus that doesn't actually happen with awareness. So what's going on here? Well, maybe it's actually what's interacting with the hippocampus that's really the important feature. So what we did is we took that hippocampal area and did a functional connectivity analysis of that area with the rest of the brain, and that's what you see here as a result of the functional connectivity analysis. It's a long segue to get to that cartoon. The top here are the dominant functional connections in the aware group. What I'm doing over here is plotting the correlations between the hippocampal region with other dominant regions in the brain amongst those regions and also with performance in the aware group. And these areas are very strongly functionally connected. So these are correlations colored, plus one being red, minus one being blue. You see strong functional connections with prefrontal cortices, occipital cortices, temporal cortices. Very strong connections amongst these areas with behavior, but no such coherent pattern in the unaware group. In the unaware group, conversely, you see a different spatial pattern involving the same, putatively the same part of the hippocampus, involving basal ganglia, thalamus, infrotemporal cortex. And I think it's rubbing on my beard, actually. This is why you should shave sometimes. You take those dominant areas, you plot them in the correlation maps, you see, again, strong functional connections with the seed, amongst the seeds, and with behavior in the unaware group, but no such coherent pattern. There are some strong correlations, but overall, the pattern isn't quite as coherent as it is in the unaware group. So again, same seed, different functional connections, different emergent behavior, different neural context. So, and that's what that basically says. So it's a nice example, again, of that principle where you have the context is really what sculpts how an area contributes to a function, not the area in and of itself, necessarily. Again, these are other examples. I'm not going to go through them. These are from non-neuroimaging studies. You can see this example of neural context in single-cell work, in vertebrates. The last example is actually a series of studies looking at the difference between prefrontal and parietal neurons in working memory, and find there really wasn't that much of a difference in the two systems in terms of the response properties. This is a very nice example of neural context from a marine mollusk, showing that the dynamics, the spatial-temporal pattern amongst the same collection of neurons can result in quite different behaviors. So it's, again, the same structural architecture, but by changing the spatial-temporal dynamics, you have quite different emergent behavior, quite different context, different behaviors, again, amongst the same set of, in this case, neural constituents. So by looking at this, what have we learned? First of all, we learned that, obviously, dynamics of networks needs to be considered when interpreting activity changes. Because of the architecture of the brain, structural architecture, there are many indirect routes which can go between different areas. Importantly, this is actually something Roberto mentioned, which is quite an interesting observation, is that you can have no net change of activity in a given node, but in fact that node can be quite critical for switching between different operations. So for example, hubs could be quite sure that characteristic where they show very little activity change, but they change their interactions, and therefore the functional networks change quite dramatically. But you're going to miss that if you look at activity by itself. Obviously, the internal and external context, that being the neural and the behavioral context, interact constrained network dynamics. So you have this interplay between internal and external environment that's important to consider, which is kind of obvious. And the function of an element can only be realized based on its embeddedness in a larger network. So where that node sits within the larger context of the network of the brain. So what is it that drives this neural context? What are the factors that allow systems to switch, potentially, sometimes spontaneously actually, between different configurations? Definitely external influences. You change the task, change the stimulus, change what you're feeling, you'll change the functional interactions. But what are the internal influences? And one thing that sort of came to mind as we were thinking this through is maybe it's actually the internal noise, the stochastic processes that are in the brain that are allowing these configurations to change. So we started moving on a series of studies looking at noise and variability of the brain and trying to see how this noise related to changing network dynamics and changing network configurations. Now, there's a very nice review article published a few years back that talks about the different levels of noise in the brain. You've heard some of this already in terms of channel noise. Where are we here? In through here. The noise, of course, is partly a function of the fact that it's a biological system and hence is imperfect from the engineering perspective. But it's actually, in some perspective, can be thought of as an adaptive response as well, because it does allow for a adaptive response to a noisy environment. That's sort of the general theory underlying why it is biological systems are noisy. Cardiac's the same, heart rate's the same. All systems in the brain show this a degree of stochasticity that seems to be really adaptive. And this is just talking about the different levels at which you see this noise. Within channels, within cells, networks of neurons, all the way down to effector systems. One area where this has been talked about in terms of the usefulness of the noise is talking about this idea of stochastic resonance, wherein when you have a nonlinear system, shown here in blue, you have a weak signal, the probability of detecting that signal actually increases with noise for a nonlinear system. But as you scale noise in the linear system, you just get progressively more crappy, as it were, in being able to detect that signal because the noise actually obscures the capacity to pull the signal from the rest of the system. This is true both for perceptual and motor responses, but also within networks. There's been very good examples, for example, from in vivo cell work looking at how the noise in synapses actually helps networks modify their responses. So the idea of complexity and noise are somehow related, and we haven't quite completely parsed that yet, so we'll just keep that in mind as we go forward. But you will see me using some of these terms interchangeably, so I apologize for the slop in my terminology, but I'm giving the talk so I can do that. And the noise we're saying actually also relates to the repertoire of the system. So I'll say this now, and I'll get back to it later, that the noisy system actually has a higher repertoire, a higher number of configurations it can take than a similar system that has less noise. And this kind of shows this idea of a repertoire in a noisy system. You'll see this slide later on as well, I'm pretty sure. Where we have three oscillators. And this is the manifold that describes the phase relationship amongst the oscillators. You see that without noise, they start out here and they kind of float down to their fixed point here. When you put in noise into this system, you find much more interesting and richer dynamics. And you can think about this not only as being more circuitous, but actually more of an exploration of configurations as the system slowly winds down to its fixed point. So in some ways, you can think of the noise as an allowing for an exploration of the possible configurations of a network architecture. We've instantiated this general principle in a large neural simulation architecture called the virtual brain down here. I'm happy to say that our first release actually went out yesterday, just in time for Brain Awareness Week. It's a fairly large-scale model. We're talking actually at neural mass models as opposed to individual neurons. And what we've done for the first part of this is take and represent a number of regions, each one by a circle here, as a mean field, and then derive the anatomical connections from what's called the COCOMAC database. It's a database that was developed originally by Rolf Cotter in Dusseldorf to catalog all the connections amongst different regions of the macaque cortex. This is based on pulling a broad collection of neuroanatomical papers, so actually tracing studies looking at what areas are connected to what. So using that information, we make the assumption that some of those connections are going to be preserved in humans, so we can make that connection between monkeys and humans, and use those constraints for the structural foundation of the model. Importantly, we preserve the actual geometrical distance between the different nodes. I think Victor will talk a bit more about that, the importance of time delays in networks like this. The nice thing is that when you have this architecture in place, you can let the model play with itself, as it were, pardon me, and generate dynamics. It can generate population activity, it can generate EEG data, it can generate MEG data. You can look at the dynamics of each individual node. You can look at the cross-correlations amongst these nodes using functional connection metrics and relate it back to empirical data. So it's quite a nice platform for talking about interfacing between empirical data and simulated data. But it also allows us to test different ideas of how it is the noise impacts changing configurations in the brain. So there's a couple of studies that looked more specifically at noise, and there's some papers that kind of discuss this in some detail. This is an example of how the noise, by scaling the noise, you get sort of optimal oscillatory behavior, and something I think Roberto also mentioned is that oscillations is really a network property. And we capture that quite nicely in this simulation. The simulations per se was actually looking at this resting state behavior that you see primarily in functional MRI data, but you also capture that also in EEG. And one of the prevalent observations from these studies has been what's called anti-correlations between large-scale networks. And that anti-correlated behavior we see in the simulation actually is very specifically dependent upon the internal noise of the system. That's what's shown here. What I'm plotting here are the time series for the yellow and green nodes. The colors are completely off. I'm sorry for that. So I can't remember which one, if it's red or red is blue and blue is red and whatever. So basically, just the red line is one network, the blue line is another network, and the black line is the difference between the two networks in terms of their phase. That phase actually is a fairly slow oscillation, which maps back nicely to the oscillations you see in empirical data. And when you look at that phase, that behavior, the behavior of that relationship between the two networks is very strongly related to the noise in the system. So the power of this slow oscillation, this is power by noise, shows a very sort of stochastic resonance kind of function. The frequency of that relationship also depends on noise, and the anti-correlation between those two networks also depends very much on the noise. So again, scaling the noise, you get this optimal behavior. If you go too far, it messes up. So the sweet spot. Stochastic resonance, very nice nonlinear function. And this basically, this model is incredibly simple. All we did is, again, put in the nodes, structural constraints that were trying to mimic the actual geometry in terms of distances and time delays, and then put in oscillations with some noise, and we get that for nothing, other than computational time, of course. Francis? Noise is additive. I think it was Gaussian in this case, right? Yeah. So the idea that noise is important in the nervous system for optimal function really isn't that new. And this is why you have graduate students who are smart asses and try and prove that the supervisors are wrong. Because I thought this was a new thing, and then this guy went and did pulled the literature and said, hey, I found this article written in 1966, when I was 2 years old, that talked about noise in the nervous system being an important thing. I'm not going to read this. Basically, what the point of that review was is really talk about the fact that this internal rumination, tonic activity in the brain, is actually quite important for normal cognitive function. It's an excellent paper, and I really encourage you to try and pick it up at some point. They mentioned some heroes of the field like Treisman, Hebb, and Lashley in this context as well. So that's the sort of the theoretical foundation that suggested that there was something to this noisy brain stuff that was important for understanding how network dynamics emerge. So the question is now, can we actually look at that behavior in real data? So we'll go through some examples now. So if brain noise reflects a repertoire, in some senses, as the brain becomes more facile, has more functional architectures it can form, it should change as the system learns stuff, as it matures, as it has more experience with the world. So can, in fact, development be partly accounted for by changes in noise structure in terms of brain function? So the hypothesis that we started these explorations with was that early maturation may actually lead to an increase in the brain noise. And conversely, in aging, that brain noise may actually reduce. So we have, again, another one is inverted U functions. So as you mature, it goes up, and then it goes down as we get more mature, like fine wine. The first study we derived from a data set that Roxanne Etier, who's there, collected when she was a PhD student, actually, in Toulouse, and she brought with her when she did a postdoc with me. Just looked at the response to faces of different sorts in kids from 8 years old to 15, as well as adults. This is the average ERP to a face for the different age groups, average within group. And you see that in the youngest group, you have a very strong initial response, and then much else happening afterwards. It's very broad, very strong, very deterministic. With maturation, that response declines in terms of its amplitude, but it also becomes faster. So you see the latency decreasing to the point where you have the adults having the typical P1 response at about 100 milliseconds, plus the other components that you typically pull up when you do evoke potential work in faces. So you go from being very deterministic to more stochastic, more complex. Okay, no surprise there. Okay, so the question was, how do we measure variability now in these data? So reduced internal noise should be related to reduced variance in measured physiological signals. So we can do at least two things, if not more. One is we can just run a principal components analysis on single trial data. The idea being is that the noisier the brain is, the higher the dimensionality, the more principal components you would need to account for a certain proportion of data. Very simple. The second thing is to look at the entropy of the signal. And this actually focuses more on the time domain. So a noisier brain, the brain that has more information processing capacity, should show higher entropy as well, or less predictability in function of times. MSC, the M part, multiscale, talks about different time scales. So I'll show you that algorithm in a second, I think. Yes. The MSC algorithm was developed by Madalena da Costa in Boston. You can actually download the tool from PhysioNet. The idea is that you have an original signal of which you measure sample entropy of that signal. And then you slowly downsample the data. And at each downsample, you measure entropy again. So you look at entropy as a function of time scale. So you do the original time series, downsample twice, three times. And at each of the time scales, you compute sample entropy and look at the entropy as a function of time scale. So this toy example that Jennifer Heiss drew up for us shows you the difference between a fairly noisy signal that has a lot of richness into it versus a fairly deterministic signal that has not much going on. You see in this toy example that sample entropy quite nicely distinguishes the two conditions. In the tutorial that's online, it shows some nice examples of how you can differentiate, for example, white noise from 1 over F noise using this thing. It quite nicely shows that the structure in 1 over F noise maintains across more scales, whereas white noise drops off quite rapidly. There's not much information beyond the original scale. Anyways, it's nice because it doesn't, in fact, take into account that there is a time signature over which information is represented in the brain. Certainly, you hear that from the spectral domain, but also if you look in the time domain as well, that time itself is multidimensional, multiscale in the brain. And to take that into account is quite important. So, the application to the EEG data, this is the PCA result. What I'm showing you here is not the evoked potential, but actually the number of dimensions for each channel. In a single trial data, and then average within groups with dimensionality estimation, pre-stimulus and post-stimulus. Youngest kids, adults, you see that with maturation, the number of dimensions needed to account for 90% of the data increases maturation, both pre- and post-stimulus. The other thing you notice is that there's a precipitous drop in dimensionality post-stimulus. And this is very, very strong in the youngest kids and much less so in the adults. So that drop in the dimensionality is quite, again, characteristic of a more deterministic system. And that level of deterministicism changes with maturation. So it becomes less deterministic with age. The MSC results show a complementary pattern. This is, again, as the sample entropy is a function of time scale, being the original and the most coarse time scale. Adults are up on the top, in cyan. And the kids then fall ordinally below them. You see pretty much across all scales of those most strong sort of this middle range here, you see increasing entropy with increasing age. The other cool thing was that these measures relate quite nicely to the performance of the individuals on this task. We found by doing the correlation across individuals between the MSC area under the curve, pre- or post-stimulus PCA, is that there was a negative correlation between variability and stability of reaction time. So the higher entropy is, the more stable your reaction time is, the more stable your behavior is. The higher the noise, higher the entropy is, the more accurate you are. So the higher the noise was in the sample, the better they were at doing the task as well. And this maintains even if you regress out age as a factor. So there is some stable relationship between having higher variability and more stable behavior in this population. A follow-up study then by Bratislav Mishik, who's there, with some data from Margot Taylor's lab at SickKids, did a complementary analysis of a slightly different data set in MEG, a wider age sample, showing the same change in entropy as a function of age. The dominant change here, if you really do a severe threshold on the data and source localize it, ends up being in this sort of medial cortices in and around precuneus, which is one of the hub areas putatively of the brain. That's very increasing variability with maturation. The nice thing is, again, that data also shows the correlation between higher variability and more stable behavior. So that's replicated again in different data sets. I'm going to skip that one. This is the awe moment where you see this lovely little child with their face planted in front of a TV screen with a hairdryer net on. This is a data set we collected, or was collected by Sarah Lipe, who's in Montreal. This is a large sample of infants. And the idea is we're looking at the same sort of developmental trajectory in that group. We have in this task, the kids were presented with either reversing checkerboard patterns or in a different session, they were presented with binaural, I think it was bandpass filtered white noise, actually, so they're tone bursts. Looking at entropy as a function of maturation, we find that, again, MSC scales with age. The time series is shorter in this data set since there's fewer time scales to look at, so you don't see the same extended curve, but you do see babies down here. This is down the 1 to 2 month old to the 24 months, and adults, as you might expect, are quite a bit more entropy than the kids do. So again, this change in noise can be tracked much, much early on in life. Here, what was kind of interesting is you do, in fact, see a difference in entropy depending on whether you have a response to auditory versus visual stimuli. In the adults, there's actually no difference between the entropy evoked by these two stimuli. But in the youngest kids, you actually see the entropy is higher for visual than auditory. And with maturation, that difference actually converges again to be not distinguishable. And there is a nice relationship between this difference and the difference in the maturation of the two systems as they come out of perinatal as well as the first few years of life. It's a nice indication of structural differences in the auditory versus visual system early on in life as the system matures. No, and that's primarily because there's not a lot of kids in there. There is, again, if you look at the literature on the structural changes, there is an interesting change in the relative balance of proliferation of synapses versus scaling back of synapses that happens right around that time. So if we had more kids in that sample, we could probably figure that out a bit more. But in this thing, not significant, unfortunately. Vasileva Korin, who's somewhere in the room, there he is, took a look at these data and asked whether we could parse this entropy measure into different levels of network representation. What talked about thus far has been looking at entropy in terms of individual channels or individual regions, for instance. But if we go back to the idea that these dynamics are really coming about through network changes, it would be nice to try and parse these entropy measures into local versus distributed noise or distributed entropy. One can do that if you look at total entropy or versus conditional entropy and mutual information here by parsing the total entropy down into local, which is attributed to the individual unit or time series or channel, versus that which is shared amongst them, essentially functional connections, if you will, versus the residual, or local versus distributed entropy is how we've talked about it in the papers. This is a spaghetti diagram showing you the differences in distributed entropy as a function of age The areas that are the red connections are those areas that show increased mutual information with maturation. This is just within the infant groups. And the blues are areas that are showing reduced mutual information. There's actually, if you do a count the number of increases versus decreases, there's a lot more increases in functional connections as a function of maturation in this group. Distributed entropy goes up, and here you see local entropy going down. So you get this change from having a very sort of local deterministic system that was much more distributed and is able to exchange information at multiple scales with maturation in kids. And we can parse that and show that quite nicely with this parsing of local versus distributed entropy in these data. Unfortunately, babies don't do much behaviorally, so we can't do a correlation of that with behavior. We can do some behaviors, but they may not be the ones we want to actually correlate with these measures. But I'll leave that one with you. Okay, so quickly, stability of behavior increases maturation. Neurophysiological variability, broadly defined, also increases maturation. Maturation brings a transition from a brain that's deterministic to one that's more stochastic, but at least in principle, more adaptive. And that probably explains the paradoxical negative correlation between behavior and brain variability. Okay, how am I doing for time? Are you guys hungry? Anybody? Oh, okay, I'm almost done anyways. So let's talk about healthy aging. This is a review article that looked at the inter-individual standard deviation of reaction time, coefficient of variation of reaction time, essentially, as a function of age. And you see that in younger individuals, the variability in your reaction time, how stable you are at pressing a button, is quite large. It declines, you get more stable with age. And then later on, there's actually a fanning out. So it's not as if it's a perfect inverted U-shape. There's actually some that do worse, some that do better. There's some young subjects down here that actually aren't too different from those. But you do see this gradation there. The question is, how does that translate now to what we see in the brain? So I'll talk about two different data sets. One's EEG, one's MEG. I'm not going to focus on the individual conditions too much because it's primarily a general finding I want to convey across both studies. So I'm just going to cover very briefly the details. We want to focus on the similarities of the results from the two studies. The first data set was EEG data. There are a number of tasks that were done, plus there was a sort of a resting state condition in there as well. We had three groups of individuals that can be parsed. We have young, 16 subjects, middle-aged, and old-age. These are all, by typical screening methods, healthy individuals. But this is entirely a visual experiment. The second data set was looking at MEG data. This is actually a multi-sensory experiment looking at both auditory and visual stimuli. We have only two groups here, young and old, so no middle-aged groups. What we want to look at is just general changes as a function of age in noise. In this case, we're going to focus entirely on the multiscale entropy measure, as well as looking at the local versus distributed entropy measure I just finished telling you about. Good? Breathe. Get your breath. Move on. Okay, this is the EEG data. This is from the posterior electrode, I think O2 or something like that, but basically it's the same pattern across the scalp. What you see here, the bubbles indicate where there's a significant difference between the curves. Again, time scale here, MSC here. Old in green, middle in blue, young in red. You see that the fine scales, that the middle and old subjects have higher entropy, whereas at the core scales, the young subjects have higher entropy. Okay, so you see a crossover, quite different from what we see in the kids. That's EEG data. MEG data, doesn't matter if you look at auditory or visual stimuli, you see the same kind of pattern. Again, scale here. At the fine scales, older subjects are higher. Core scales, younger subjects are higher entropy. which means that the changes in entropy are very much dependent upon time scale. Not too surprising, I guess, in some respects, because you wouldn't expect it to be quite an egregious change in networks in normal aging, otherwise it'd be really messed up. I think what's happening in early development, you have quite a few changes happening. You have pruning, you have myelination changing, plus you have experience. All this is happening in young kids. As you become an adult, hopefully it's not quite as prevalent, otherwise I said we'd get messed up quite quickly. There are more subtle changes in terms of the structure and functional architecture in the brain. This is captured by the fact that these differences as a function of age do depend on time, but they also depend on space as well, which I'll show you in a second. If you look at the parsing of local and distributed entropy, you'll see the spatial dependence of these patterns as well. This is a complicated diagram showing for the EEG data. This is a matrix of sources that are source projections from the EEG data. So each of the squares corresponds to a source. You can't read the labels, don't worry about that. This is a cross-hemisphere mutual information, within-hemisphere mutual information, and this is local entropy for each of the individual channels or sources. And these are the areas that decrease their functional connections, if you will, or distributed entropy as a function of age, and these are the ones that increase as a function of age. So in the EEG data, the dominant change is actually a reduction of distributed entropy across the hemispheres. So it's very spatially dependent, these changes. And local entropy generically increases for most areas. There's some variation in the regions, but basically you have an increase in local entropy, decrease in distributed, but it really depends on the cross-hemispheric connections predominantly. In the MEG data, it's actually even more obvious. These are unthresholded maps, so I just want to make sure you capture that. So I'm not putting any statistical thresholds on these at all, other than greater than zero or less than zero. In the MEG data, you see the similar pattern where the dominant change is actually the cross-hemispheric distributed entropy measures. Within hemisphere increases with age, the cross-hemisphere decreases with age. And again, local entropy generically increases in normal aging. So again, very spatial and temporal dependence in terms of how these networks change. Very important feature, which I think Victor also talked about, is the space-time structure of these networks is really, really critical in understanding how these systems are working and how they're changing with age. Very briefly, I'll talk about some clinical conditions where these measures of variability can change, where noise, if you will, changes as a function of that condition. There's some work from a group in Germany. Jörg Winter here is the primary person doing that work, looking at the noise in schizophrenic brain. And their data suggests that there's actually an increase of noise in schizophrenia. A lovely paper looking at the fluctuations of spectral power in kids with EEG. This is actually some work Vera did as well as Jose Luis and group, finding that the fluctuations, the degree of noise, if you will, in the spectral domain actually was predictive of how well the kids would recover from concussion or from actually close. They were actually comatose when they came in the clinic, right? So is that a definite, obviously clinical relevance then to the capacity to measure this noise? If you have more noise for the same level of clinical expression of comatose, you actually tend to improve more rapidly than a kid who did not have the same level of variability. Even more practically speaking, there's now a huge movement to make neuroprostheses that try and mimic the biological noise that helps improve the operation of these prosthetic devices. This is a very good example of how you can do that with vibrating socks, if you will. So people have peripheral neuropathy from diabetes, for example. They have a tendency to not be able to get proper feedback when they're walking around, will tend to fall quite a bit. If you have these prosthetic devices, basically vibrating socks, it increases the noise in the system, much like stochastic resonance. They tend to be able to catch themselves when they're moving too far to one side versus another. You don't want to get them wet, of course, because that kind of screws up the whole thing, but at least in principle it should work. This is a study we just got published in Neuroimaging looking at patients who have had traumatic brain injury. they're recovered, they're back into the community, but they still continue to show some changes in brain dynamics. If you measure, again, the MSC as a function of time scale, you find that the TBI patients have similar entropy at local scales, but core scales, i.e. the long-range connections, seem to show decreased entropy in the TBI patients. We find, much like we have mentioned earlier, and this is again consistent with what's seen in other studies of patient groups, is that even if the noise is somewhat lower in the patient group, those patients who have higher noise are ones that are actually doing better. And that's what this graph shows you, is that the patients who, again, have recovered, if you look at the performance in the task, those that have higher noise are those that are actually more stable in their behavior in doing this task. Patients, again, are in this sort of purpley thing, whereas the healthy controls are in blue. Both groups show that trend, but it's more accentuated in the patient group. So more noise, in this case, is actually good for civil behavior in the brain. So a lot of stuff on noise there, eh? But what did we learn from all that? It seems that maturation results in an increase in brain signal variability. And that's not because of more artifact, just because that's the way the brain's evolving. That seems to actually come with increased behavior stability. We also saw that there are additional changes in normal aging, which kind of mimics the inverted U-shape I talked about earlier, going from low noise to high noise in here, but it depends on space and time. So again, as you might expect, as we mature and get older, it's not as if we demyelinate completely, which is good, trust me. We have regional changes that will affect the spatial temporal structure of these networks, and that's captured quite nicely in these measures, that space and time are important in thinking about how the brain is changing. It will change the task demands. I didn't mention any of that stuff, but it does, in fact, slow subtle changes depending on the cognitive task you're doing. We don't actually know is what is the optimal amount in a normal brain for having this noise to explore what's possible, but also to not push you too far out of an attractor manifold. So generally speaking, if we want to wrap this up so you can get some food, the brain operates through networks, not regions. I'm pretty sure everybody in this room agrees with that, so I'm not saying anything too controversial. Networks can have overlapping constituents but support different functions, and that's the idea of neural contexts. And again, because of the architecture of the brain, that is why this change in the repertoire, or change of the role, I should say, of a region can change depending on what areas it's talking to. A certain amount of noise seems to be important for normal function, and this noise seems to emerge with maturation. From a perspective of nonlinear dynamical systems, the noise enables multistability. It allows different spatial temporal signatures to be instantiated and is a reflection of the repertoire of the system. The more areas it can explore, the more attractors it has in the space, if you will. And the scale dependency is quite nicely emphasized in normal aging. There's obviously interplay of noise and function. We're still exploring how that actually works across the spectrum. And the final statement is basically that the brain, through this emergence of network architectures and multiscale noise, is in a constant state of exploring what is possible. With that, I'll thank you for your attention.